Guardian Unlimited.
I'm John Mullen, and I'm here at the Guardian Book Club to interview Graham Swift about his novel The Light of Day. I've joked with authors previously. I remember we had Doris Lessing here, and I said, well, you know, if you're an academic, it's a bit like having George Eliot in the seminar room with you. But Graham actually is a set text on the course that I've been teaching this term. So I've come not only with my own sort of dubious insights, but with the students' ones. And I'll be tactful because we discussed your work, this novel, Graham, alongside other, in a course called London in Literature, alongside other contemporary novels about London. But there were some non-controversial things we noticed, which have certainly changed since George Eliot's day. Like, it was pointed out that the male protagonists of contemporary novels set in London tend to be quite good at cooking nowadays, and that there's a bit of a cultural trend there.
I wasn't aware of this, but
yes. But I wanted to start actually by talking about something to do with something that's characteristic, I don't know, of quite a lot of your novels before The Light of Day. There's a brilliant sort of for sort of desperate teachers, very useful British Council website on contemporary novelists, which kind of provides not just biographical details, but sort of usually an unerringly clear and accurate resume of themes. Unfortunately, the one on you hasn't got up to speed with this novel yet, so I haven't been able to use it for that. But one thing it says is, his novels are frequently organised around an underlying mystery, and his oblique narrative technique lends itself to a gradual revelation of events in a manner reminiscent of a 19th century detective novel. And I just wanted to ask about the mystery, the plot, if you like, of The Light of Day. Because in your previous novel, Last Orders, and sort of, I suppose, in others as well, in Waterland, there's a kind of... you find out stuff near the end of the novel, which explains a lot. And in The Light of Day, it seems that there's a kind of mystery that you're introduced to quite early on. A mystery of, I suppose, why Sarah Nash, the woman that the narrator's obsessed with, mm-hmm. murders her husband. Mm. And then the mystery is sort of determinedly preserved to and beyond the end of the novel. And I wondered having read the British Council website too often, I was kind of expecting a sort of a turnaround there, a twist, as I kind of got in the previous novel. But you were determined to keep that mystery, and I wondered why that was.
It's a complicated question. I was waiting for the question.
Sorry, it's an academic's question.
You introduce this under the sort of heading mystery, and I think there is a lot of mystery in The Light of Day. But of course, one of the mysteries is not a mystery at all. I mean, given that this novel is about a murder, we certainly know very early on in the book who committed the murder. We know who did it. And so there is one element of mystery is completely cleared up. I mean, I think the mysteries are elsewhere. But I think I want to pick up immediately on a word that you used in somewhere in the middle of your question, which I would like you to tell me about. And that was the word obsessive. Do you remember using
that? I do. Bad word, yes. Obsessive. What, you want me to tell you why I use that?
I would be interested to know why you use it.
Okay. Well, That's a good question because, well, okay. Because it seems to be a novel, it's in the first person. Mm-hmm. And it's a novel about a man who seems compelled, as if it were a duty, to perform these sort of actions, which includes visiting this woman in mm-hmm. prison on a certain day, but he visits her every fortnight. Mm-hmm. Initially in the face of sort of discouragement or certain total lack of encouragement. And I suppose one of the peculiarities of the book, one of the things which to me makes it really gripping but also perplexing, is that it's so much a matter of his narrative, a lot of it almost a sort of a narrative inside his head, inside his memories in particular, that you don't, I mean, what you get is his not even his feelings, because he's quite inexpressive as well in some ways. What you get is her as she is there for him, rather than her.
What makes you think that he is inexpressive? I would say that this narrator in this novel is a man who might not once have been expressive, but is now actually highly expressive.
Mm.
He has discovered an expressiveness inside him which perhaps he had not known was there. But this is a highly expressive man, and a highly articulate man, and a highly intelligent man, and a man who is discovering this man who was inside him, and it's all coming out. This is a character who is coming. There's an expression that is sometimes used when someone comes into the fullness of their life. This is happening to George. So to say that in the novel, as you read it, he is inexpressive seems to me extraordinary.
Well,
and as extraordinary as saying that he is obsessive, because that implies that he is some kind of clinical case, which is patently not true either.
But he's inexpressive in that you've very carefully given him a language which is forged out of worn idioms and...
No. Insofar as I have given him a language, I have given him a language, and it's not really like giving a language. When you have a character who comes alive for you, you don't give them a language, they acquire a language. He has a language which belongs to him, George, and it's a very expressive language.
But it's a language which comes from taking usually easily observed or uninterrogated phrases or words that we use and kind of holding them up to the light?
Yes and no. I mean, this man is, I'm assuming that most of you might have read this book. This man is a detective, a private detective, a former policeman. So he has, and that's part of his character. So he has a language which goes with his character, which is the language of observing things, sort of noting things as a detective or a policeman might. So it's quite terse, it's quite sort of brief often, but at the same time, this man is a bit of a poet. There are some extraordinarily lyrical moments in this novel, and they come from him.
Mm.
They're not imposed upon him, they come from him.
But the lyrical bits, aren't they usually to do with his observation of things like light and weather and of the external
sometimes,
world?
Sometimes, but no, not always, no. They're to do with anything that he wants to observe in a lyrical way.
Okay,
which he often does.
Well, look, let me ask you about, I suppose, the best example of what I was trying to get at, which is his use, or the novel's use, but I mean, the novel's all his in a sense. I mean, his use of clichés. The novel...
you say his use of clichés, but... Are you suggesting that George is a man who thinks here's a cliche and I should use
it? No, I think the use of cliches is brilliant. I think that's one of the best. I mean, that's one of the things I most. I mean, it's
he just uses now and then the words and phrases that a lot of us use, and whether he thinks of them as a cliche or not is neither here nor there.
Yes, but he does surely think of them sometimes as he himself takes these sayings and turns them over and thinks about them.
Give me an example.
Okay, I will find. He loves cliches. Money for old rope.
Oh, now, come on. Look, when someone uses the phrase money for old rope, is that exhibiting a love of cliche? It's a phrase we all use. And, of course, the fact that we all use it means that it is a cliche. But it's not as though he has chosen it because of its cliche kind of value. It's just a phrase we use.
Okay, how about this? He's talking about going to the prison and waiting to get into the prison. Is there a life anyway which isn't half made of waiting, studded with detentions, worth the wait? Give it time. Nothing good can be hurried, like cooking. I mean, isn't he there taking the things people say, worth the wait?
No,
give it time.
No. He's just saying those things in the way that lots of people just say those things and use those phrases. And, I mean, what are you making of this? An ordinary man using ordinary words, that's all it is.
Well, I suppose what I'm making is I'm saying that he's kind of releasing the weight, the significance of those ordinary words and those ordinary phrases.
No. I mean, if he had some literary agenda, he would be doing that, but he's a private detective visiting this woman in prison, and those are the words that pass through his head. It's as simple as that.
But she's teaching him to write things, isn't she?
That is also true, but they are his words anyway. So what is your point?
Well, that he says that he writes, he gives an account of things which he takes to her, and she reads it and she comments on
it. Yes, I mean, that's certainly true. One element, it's not a huge element of the novel, is that there he is visiting this woman who, ironically for him, for the character, for George, is or rather was a teacher. And George has always had this thing about teachers. He's never liked teachers. So here he is with this extraordinary attachment to a teacher. A teacher in prison, and teachers sometimes end up in prison. And part of the visiting of her involves a sort of teacher-pupil relationship because she suggests to him, at least, that something he might like to do is to write things, put things down on words, and bring into her as a sort of, I mean, there's a sort of joke about it being homework, but what he's really doing is something much more important. He is bringing the world into Sarah. And one of the ways that he can do by writing down the world on pages and bringing it into her. So it rather goes beyond the teacher-pupil relationship. And I think, anyway, that George is responding to this sort of teaching process, but what he is really discovering is that he had the ability, anyway, to say things, to articulate things. It was there inside him. He didn't know it until now, and it's all coming out.
He says, I never used to think about words, doesn't he?
Yes, he says, I never used to hold words up to the light and look at them in a special way, and he's doing that now. But he always had the capacity to do that. And so he is undergoing a form of education, but it's a very big form of education. It's the education that occurs when he makes this commitment to this woman in this extraordinary fashion. This woman has killed her husband. And for 2 years now, he has been visiting her and he has been undergoing a kind of education. What does education mean? It means leading out. George has come out of himself in a remarkable way.
So can I ask you about one of the most extraordinary aspects of his narrative, which is that it's something we've already touched on. It's split between present and past tenses. So he goes through the day, we go through this day, this particular 20th Thursday, the 20th of November day. And then also he moves back to various kinds of recollection. Why did you choose, I suppose, thinking of some other recent novels about a day in London, and actually, coincidentally, we were talking earlier about John Lanchester's Mr. Phillips, that's narrated in the present tense, and lots of people, I suppose, will know Ian McEwan's Saturday narrated in the present tense. So was that an important sort of decision for you? I mean,
I think it was kind of unavoidable for this novel. It had to be focused around this day, but actually this is something I've done before.
Yeah.
Last Orders was written on one level. It was following the course of a day when a man's last wishes are carried out. I'm about to publish a new novel which actually follows the course of one night on one level, but also, like Last Orders, it delves back in time considerably, as does The Light of Day. In all these cases, including The Light of Day, the day is incredibly special. And in the case of The Light of Day, it could not be more special. It's the anniversary, second anniversary of a murder. And therefore we know that we're going to relive that previous day, that day 2 years ago when the murder occurred. It coincides with one of these all-important visits that George makes to Sarah. It's also a day, we learn, when George has more than one particular mission to carry out. He doesn't just go to see Sarah. I mean, that's the most central part of the day. He does a number of other significant things. So the day could not be more special. And therefore, how else could you have written this novel than to write it around the course of the day and make that the focus? I think, I mean, this has often been done in literature. This is the point you're making. Novels written which follow a day. And I think one reason why writers do it is a much broader reason. It's because a day, or the day, is one of the classic proverbial images for life. You know, you think of all the phrases, life is but a day, seize the day. It's one way we have of focusing on life. The day that we have.
Yeah, Saul Bellow wrote a novel in a day.
Exactly, it's the life that we have. And, you know, the day represents the brevity of life, the fragility of life. It certainly represents the immediacy of life, the nowness of life. And this is a book which is absolutely full of nowness. Every moment, every little incident, every little detail of this day, we know from the start is going to be observed intensely and even glowingly. I mean, that's not just to do with the light, mm-hmm. of the weather. It's to do with something else. But everything in this day has a kind of electricity to it. This is a man whose nerves are super sensitive.
Is that also a matter of location? Because all the apparently, I was told after, unfortunately, I'd written my article for The Guardian about novels set in a day, and I'd sort of suggested that it sort of slightly started with kind of modernist novelists, and then unfortunately I bumped into a colleague of mine, John Sutherland, and he said, oh yes, 1864, the first one, George Augustus Sala, and a novel which I haven't read, needless to say, but apparently this, the first ever novel in a day, was called Twice Round the Clock, and it was set amongst in a small location in central London, and Sala actually made a novel out of observing the life of those streets over a 24-hour cycle. And all the sort of other novels that sort of one thinks of, you know, like Ulysses and Mrs. Dalloway, they seems to be the novel in a day, seems to be also a novel in an area, in a locale, and usually in a city as well. So, I mean, was it vital to this novel that it be where it is?
Novels have to be set somewhere. This one happens to be set in Wimbledon. So you get a lot of Wimbledon in this novel. I could imagine all of the same things happening somewhere else, but Wimbledon was kind of handy. But you know, what I like to think is the intensity of this novel. It's not an intensity due to Wimbledon.
No, I wasn't trying
it's
to
due to something.
But it's but isn't it due to the fact that he is? He has to follow people. He talks quite a lot about following people. So the novel's not just a matter of a location. It's a matter of routes, isn't it? And routes which he follows and refollows. And partly the narrative of it, or the memories that he goes back over for the reader, are also gone back over in following certain routes.
He has his territory. He's a detective who has an office in Wimbledon. Wimbledon and its environs, that's his territory, and he's come to know it pretty well. So it's obviously a novel about a man who's very familiar with his locality. Fair enough. But I really think the force of the novel is about something else than, you know, where we are. Something we haven't mentioned yet.
Well,
maybe we will mention.
Well, what is it that we haven't mentioned?
It's about love. Yeah. For goodness sake, this is a love story. Why he sees everything so intensely is because of love. He's in love with this woman. It's a love story.
And what does she feel about him?
What she feels about him is all in the novel.
Well, at the end, in the last chapter of the novel, which I suppose is, which is quite a hopeful last chapter.
I believe so.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, so I've got that right anyway. the last chapter of the novel is also in the present tense, but it's actually about the future. What he hopes and imagines.
He's certainly thinking of the future,
And I mean, I suppose I have known readers of this novel, I'm not one of them, who felt that the last chapter, although it could be hopeful, that actually, okay, she at first wouldn't receive his visits, now she does. Now he writes for her, she writes for him. But that there's no way of knowing that last chapter isn't his fantasy as well, to use a different word for hope.
Well, fantasy and hope are very different words. They don't sort of elide together very easily. And absolutely assure you that at no point when I was writing this novel was I writing about a fantasist.
No.
George is not a fantasist. He is a realist. I mean, he deals with the real world as occupationally. He's a detective, he's a former policeman, he knows the real world. And he's absolutely not a fantasist.
But he can't know that she will...
Well, no one knows the future. I mean, George is not exceptional in that way. But I don't think the end of the novel is, if you are suggesting this, is a delusion.
No, but it's uncertain, isn't it?
In the sense that the future is uncertain, but there's no uncertainty about the feeling involved.
Mm. But of course, a peculiar.
And why should you want there to be an
uncertainty? No, I don't want there to be. I don't want there to be. But you say there's no certainty. Of course, as it were, beyond the end of the novel, there can't be. But one of the peculiar processes in the novel is that there is a kind of certainty about George's future for at least a certain span of time, which is because this woman's in prison, he's going to go on visiting her.
Yeah.
And it's only what happens after that. So there's a sentence, isn't there? She has a sentence, and it's a sentence he is sort of sharing with her. Mm. And so there is a kind of certainty about that.
Well, I think there's no doubt. I mean, this is the second anniversary of the dreadful event of the murder. So, I mean, 2 years is a long enough time for both the characters, George and Sarah, to have worked out how they feel about where they are and about each other. And I think there is no doubt about how they feel. And there is no doubt about how George is going to approach the future. And to some extent how Sarah is going to approach the future. There is a lot of evidence in the novel for how reciprocal their feelings are. I think it's... I find it rather extraordinary that you should feel there's any element of fantasy.
No, I don't feel there is. I don't feel there is.
Or indeed, to come back to that word obsession, this is not about obsession. It's about love.
What about, I mean, the prison visiting part of the novel? I think there was, I wasn't the first to notice this, but I remember Hermione Lee reviewed it in The Guardian, and she suggested there was a kind of, that was a sort of process, not in all your novels, but that has recurred, the idea of visiting somebody who is in some ways confined, not necessarily in a prison, perhaps in a hospital, or, it happens in Last Orders, of course, where Amy is visiting a daughter who doesn't apparently even recognise her anymore. And that's a duty, isn't it, Aura? And in Waterland, his wife
She has to be visiting.
I mean, is it true to say that that's a sort of... George actually says everyone ought to be made to do it, perhaps, at one stage. Go in and then come out again.
Well, yeah. I mean, George is talking about prison.
Yeah.
I mean, I completely accept the general point you're making, that in a lot of my novels, a lot of visiting goes on. I have something about visiting under rather constrained circumstances. I mean, you discover when you write these things, they just come up over and over again. That's how it is. George is visiting a woman in prison. He knows a bit about prison anyway because of his police career. One of the things he says at some point is, as you say, everyone should be made to do this. Everyone should go into a prison at some point in their life, whether it's to visit someone or not, and come out again, because that will give the experience of being taken away from the world and then being given the world back. When you visit someone in prison, that's what happens. It's brief. You go in, then you're released again immediately. It's not like that if you're a prisoner, of course, but he's really saying that experience of having the world taken away from you and then given back to you is a marvellous experience, because then you really appreciate the world.
I used to have it every day I worked in a prison for a year, actually.
Well, then you are lucky.
Well, I don't know. The prisoners used to call, not always, but occasionally say to me, as I left at the end of my shift, so to speak, I was teaching in a prison, I bet you feel bad.
Mm.
I bet you feel bad.
Mm.
And I suppose perhaps at first I did, actually, but I got sort of inured to it a bit. Mm. But
well, I think George would have been into prison many times.
Yes.
And one sort of advantage he has when he goes to visit Sarah is that he does know what a prison is like. He knows what is in store for Sarah, more than Sarah does. He knows what she's going to go through. He's been in prisons many times. But his present situation of visiting her is... I think he says at one point, this is all the wrong way around. He says, it's not that you are locked in, it's that I'm locked out. You know, there is a way in which he wants to be in prison with her. And of course that's exceptional. That's not the normal experience of visiting someone in prison. So there are a lot of reversals of imprisonment in the novel.
And why is it important that he was, I suppose, sort of disgraced, if that's not too strong a word, as a policeman, that he had to leave, he had to become a private detective because of something he actually did which was wrong?
It's not important, it's what happened.
Mm.
Yes, in novels, things happen. They're not necessarily important. It so happens that George, who was a policeman and probably quite a good policeman, sort of overstepped a mark in the way he behaved as a policeman, and he got pushed out. Then he becomes a detective. There is a way in which he is always a policeman at heart. He has a policeman's instincts. He has a very strong sense of right and wrong. He has a very strong sense of duty. He has a very strong sense of being in a role of protection. And in a way, his whole extraordinary history with Sarah begins with a desire to protect, which I think he still has.
Mm-hmm.
There's a phrase which he uses over and over again. He says, the mysterious instinct, desire to protect. Why should people want to protect each other? There's no reason for that, but he has it. Even when he's following Bob and Christina on this fateful night when they go to the airport, he wants to protect everyone. He wants to protect them. He certainly wants to protect Sarah. He would like her to have her husband back. It's when he follows him back to the house, it's as though he's shepherding him back to the place he should be. His instincts are extremely benevolent. This is a good man.
He has... you talked about his sort of... You turned away my thought that he was somebody who likes to hold clichés up to the light, and I think about him as an imaginative person.
Which he certainly is.
And one of the... And you mentioned he's... Certain phrases, certain words even, that he comes back to, that he repeats, and one of them... One of the phrases that he uses a lot, which to me is sort of the phrase that introduces his outreaches of imagination, is as if he's, you know, I can hardly think of a narrator who more often says, it was as if, yeah. As if, as if. I asked one of my colleagues in English language if there's actually a word for this kind of... And he said, "Oh, simile." I said, "It's not a simile,
I
analogy."
I think the word might be subjunctive. That'd be horrible, wouldn't it?
Well,
as if is a very subjunctive kind of point of view. But he is. I totally agree with you. He's a very imaginative man, and he doesn't quite know how imaginative he is. And lots of the episodes and sort of scenes in the novel which I don't know what it's like to read this novel if you haven't written it, which might read as though they are the actual relation of events that occurred, are George's imagination of what happened. The murder itself,
yeah.
There is a chapter near the end where the murder is, as it were, described. In fact, that is George imagining it as he thinks it might have happened. And as I think, he's pretty close to the mark. There are several scenes. There's a scene where he imagines you have this girl, Christina, the kind of asylum seeker figure, who at some stage lives with Sarah and Bob in their house in Wimbledon. And George imagines what it was like when she first arrived in this house, carrying in her things. He imagines her breaking down and sobbing because of the pressure of circumstance. He imagines Sarah comforting her. He imagines the husband, Bob, thinking, what do I do here? And Bob prowls around and observes the scene of comforting taking place and realizes that he can't do what his wife can do, which is to just hug this poor girl. He can't do that for obvious reasons. Although that is the sort of germ of what is going to happen between her and him later on. All of that is what George imagines. There's no way of knowing if that actually happens, but isn't it very fine imagining, and isn't it very close to what could have happened?
I suppose it is, yes, yeah. It is, but that, and it gives, I mean, for me, the kind of, I suppose, cliche is haunting, but that there's a certain melancholy aspect to that which grips me, which is that he's a detective, he follows people, he imagines things, he's a spectator or a witness and an imaginer of things that he doesn't know about, can only put together. So there's something, I don't know, vicarious is the wrong word, but there's something, he's like an outsider to...
I don't think so. Isn't he doing what we're all capable of doing? I mean, we don't have to be detectives to imagine what it's like to be in someone else's shoes, to imagine an episode in someone else's life. We can all do that. It's empathy. I mean, it's imagination, it's empathy, it's something a detective might have to do for precise professional reasons. Put themselves in someone else's position, but surely it is an essential thing to being human and existing with other people. We need to imagine what it's like to be them.
If anybody, yes, please, Sam, you've got.
We've been talking about people so far. I mean, one of the things that really struck me was the way that George imagines what inanimate things are thinking about and their memories. I mean, he has one thing where he talks about houses and how, you know, the people in them come and go and do things and the houses stay. He talks about the cemetery after dark and what's happening in that. He talks, there's some metaphorical ones like Bob Saab looking like him or having a sort of certain emotional weight. I mean, is that connected with the love thing? Is it seeing things and everything? Or was that something you consciously did? Or just
well, I think that's part of his kind of general poetry, if I can call it that. He does have a feeling for certain inanimate things, and particularly you say houses. There's a lot about houses in this novel, and he is very responsive to the idea of a house containing the secret life that every house contains. And I mean, this is partly a detective's idea because his business is secrets. But any house contains the lives that are in it, were in it, and all those mysteries and secrets. And there is a passage where George he puts forward this idea, which of course is impossible to carry out. He says, supposing we could take off the roofs of houses, take off the lids of houses, and see what is inside. And he said, what would it all add up to? Would it add up to misery, or would it add up to happiness, basically, is what he's saying. And of course, none of us can do this, none of us knows the answer to that question, but I think George's feeling is it's towards the happy side, it's towards the good side, if only because that is what he has discovered in himself. There's another point in the novel where he describes himself as a house. He says, I am like a house with all the lights on inside. So he's a poet.
Yes.
Yes, but I must say I enjoyed reading this enormously, particularly the way you move from the day to the history and so on. To return, I must say with some mixed feelings to the issue of love or obsession. I mean, as I read it, it seemed to be like obsessive love, whether that it is a possibility or not, but certainly that's how it seemed to me. But what I was interested in was Rita. I mean, you talked about him as being a realist, yet it seemed to me that Rita was sort of, as it were, sitting in front of him, offering him some kind of a realistic relationship.
Absolutely.
And yet
yes.
He was, in
absolutely.
Fact, I would use the word obsession because I know you don't mind it, but he was preoccupied anyway.
No, it's not that I don't like the word, it's not that I don't like the word obsession.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a place for the word obsession. I don't think it's appropriate in this case. And you say that Rita is there, as it were, on offer in front of him, and that is totally true. But the fact that he, as it were, I mean, he has taken up the offer, but the fact that he doesn't continue the offer is a measure of how he's moved into some other dimension, where Rita no longer is a claim him. Believe me, I'm extremely fond of Rita. Nonetheless, Rita and George are not going to be the future. And George knows that. He knows that almost from page 3. He says Rita's going to quit. He knows what's going on with Rita. Rita's going to leave me. He knows that. Nonetheless, he is sure in his mind of where he is going.
Well, I felt that Rita was going to leave him because of where he was in his mind.
Well, which is also true.
Yes.
Because Rita is Rita. That's Rita's mind.
Yes.
That's what... Rita's definitely going to go off somewhere else. She has tried as hard as she can to do what she can with George.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, George is somewhere else.
She's quite scornful about Sarah, isn't she? She calls her a nasty piece of work.
She says of Sarah that she's a nasty piece of work. She also says of George, or rather George preempts Rita's conclusion about himself, that he's a sad case, that he's following a cold trail. George knows that that's not the whole story. He is able to completely, almost serenely, glide through the notion that he's a sad case. He's not a sad case.
Yes, at the back.
To expand on what John said about using the language of cliché, and he said, no, it's just the language of an everyday person.
Yeah.
For me, I found the language is very much tied to the fact that the character was a detective, and that he was a now sort of off-duty policeman.
Yeah.
It was a very language which you would expect from someone of that profession. We also looked at, in John Mullen's seminar group for the London in Lit, we also looked at Ian McEwan's Saturday, and the protagonist is a neurosurgeon. And we discussed how that would colour the way that he speaks, the language he uses, and the way he views the world. I didn't know whether you believe that George speaks that way because he's just an ordinary person, or because he's a detective and he's a policeman, and that's why it affects these clichés or the language which he uses.
Oh, I think up to a certain point, to a certain extent, you can say that George's language is the language of his occupation. It's the language of a man who's for many years been accustomed to observing the world in a particular way for his job, of making notes all the time, and having to do that quite quickly, and so it's quite terse and short often. But where we are now, the man who for 2 years has been visiting Sarah in prison, something else has also occurred, something has blossomed, even in his very language. And there are these moments, and actually I defy anyone to not find one on almost every page in the novel, where he says something quite extraordinary, which is not a policeman's language at all. It's a completely different kind of language. And I don't think that would have happened simply because of some external influence. I think it's happening because this other creature was always there inside him, and it's now just coming out.
What I found very intriguing was that George kept looking at Sarah's knees. Anyone looking at my knees, I keep them well covered up, because that would be unnecessary, a very attractive part of a woman's body.
Okay,
this is what you find.
What a marvellously specific question. I keep my own knees mainly covered as well. Well, you say he's always looking at women's knees. I don't think he's always looking at women's knees. There is a moment when Sarah comes into his office and she takes off her coat and she sits down. And the sun, it's an October day, the low sun is coming in through his office window, and it happens... it strikes his desk and it strikes her knees. So her knees are very noticeable. And he, I think in a slightly ironical way, he remembers this. He remembers her knees. And there's no doubt that he found her knees attractive. This can happen. And he remembers the light on her knees. And he's trying to find, as though he needs to, a reason for why he feels the way he does about her. And he said, well, maybe it was her knees. But he knows that's not the full explanation.
Why did you, as a writer, not mention her ankles or her nose, my knees?
Well, you know, about everything like that, you can say why not. You know, you focus on certain things. Actually, there are other parts of Sarah that are... mentioned and remembered. He sees the way the colour of her hair changes in the same sunlight. The extraordinary thing is he's totally attached to this woman. With whom he's only had these few moments of what you have to call freedom. When she was in his office, when they had a cup of coffee in a cafe, and when they met for a drink. These are terribly important, precious memories of her when she was a woman before she became a murderer. And I think over and over again you see little bits of her. You see the profile of her face when she's sitting beside him in the cafe. It's not just the knees.
Yes?
Yeah, John asked you about the location, and you sort of suggested it wasn't that significant, but I think sense of place is very important in all those. And can't believe that, you know, you're setting Wimbledon.
No, you're right. Yeah, I was sort of playing it down a bit. I think strong locality is actually pretty important. I'm not sure that I've always believed this as a novelist. I think when I started out, I didn't think that place and setting were the most important elements in a novel, and I still don't think that, but I think they are very important. And I don't think you sort of, in a way, get anywhere until you have very convincingly established your starting point, your location, which in this case is Wimbledon. It so happens that I live very near Wimbledon. I don't live in Wimbledon. I live in SW18. Wimbledon is SW19. Pretty close. So, sort of on my doorstep. But I'm actually not... Research is not a big thing for me. So I didn't go to Wimbledon and follow all the little routes and corners and so on. While I was writing the novel, I did it after I'd finished quite a lot. And the Wimbledon that you get in the book is... You can track everything down to the real Wimbledon, but while I was writing it, it was really all in my head. It was a very imagined Wimbledon, which I had to sort of check up on later. But it was quite convenient that it was so close and that I had been there. I mean, I sometimes think that... I wrote this novel called Waterland, which is set... in a very peculiar region of East Anglia, which is certainly not my region, it's not where I come from, has a very strong sense of place. In a way, it's a sort of exception in my work, because most of my other books I have used, simply because it's close to hand, some London setting or other, and in this case it's Wimbledon.
Likewise, why 1995?
I just,
the murder is in 1995. I just haven't read it or the other, but I noticed the night in question there is
1995.
So it
happens. A coincidence that has occurred to me, but there's nothing in it. It's just it is a coincidence. It has to be in the mid 1990s in the light of day because of the character Christina, who is this person who has come from, as it was at the time she left, Yugoslavia, and then all hell has broken loose in the country she's come from, so she cannot go back. She comes as a student to London, and then terrible things happen, indeed to her family, where she comes from, and of course this is all what happened in the mid-1990s. So it has to be that time for that reason. Simple as that.
I think that other novel we mentioned about a day in London, Mr. Phillips, is actually set in 1995 as well. When we talked about it, somebody in the audience said, why 1995?
Well, I think there's generally a way in which, you see, I don't believe, if I can make a bold statement, I don't believe in the contemporary novel. I don't believe in a novel which is written about the year now, whenever we are. Almost for practical reasons, how can that be? Novels take a long time to write. So if you say, I'm going to write about 2007, by the time you finish, 2007 is 3 years down the road. And I think most novels which are loosely called contemporary are actually novels which take stock of a time, maybe a decade or more, before they are published. And that's always been the case. A lot of Dickens novels, which you think of as being contemporary to the time he wrote them, were about a sort of slightly previous time. I think it's just the way novels work.
I just wondered if you had a definite feeling for how life was going to turn out for these characters.
In the future?
Yeah.
Well, of course I don't know. The novelists don't know what's going to happen after the end of the novels. I think that's generally true. They are no authority on that. But so you can only judge on what you have in the novel. And I think what you have in the novel is, I would say, and I'm the author around here, tends very strongly to the hopeful and optimistic view about the future. And I know this is an extraordinary situation because Sarah may be in prison for at least another 8 years. But after all, George has been making these visits already for 2 years. He's had time to mature about what he's doing, to understand what he's doing. And I think, and I don't want to sort of list them and elaborate them, but there are all kinds of signs in this novel that something is already established between the two of them, and it will go on and it will continue.
Well, thanks very much. And Graham, you've signed some books if
yes,
people like that. And just to say thank you to Graham, not only for having written a powerful novel, but having come and spoken so powerfully about it too. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Guardian Unlimited.